it doesn't matter if other people don't understand, you know, how my brain works or who I am. It doesn't even matter if they don't agree for whatever reason. But that unconditional acceptance, that unconditional support is so important. I think that's so powerful.
All right, we're on it.
I wonder what you mean when you use the word I. Use the word I.
Take a break.
We have an aversion to ourselves and to what's happening inside us.
I've been very interested in this problem for a long, long time.
Something settles.
Today's guest is Sunny Jain, a multi-neurodivergent, queer and disabled public speaker, advocate and author with a strong social media presence. They are also the co-chair of the National Autism Strategy Social Inclusion Working Group. Sunny was diagnosed as a child and grew up only hearing a deficit narrative around their neurodivergence. Since then, they've gone on to build an audience of over 100,000 people online, have written the Neurodivergent Friendly Workbook of DBT Skills, have worked with organizations and services around Australia to help change the narrative around neurodivergence, and create the first drop-in center in Adelaide CBD to provide a safe space for people who identify as LGBTQIA+, disabled or neurodivergent. I thought just before we dive into the episode, it would be good to clarify some terms because there was a bunch that I didn't even know. So neurodiversity refers to the diversity of all human minds and the unique ways that they can exist, think, act, process, and feel. It's a fundamental truth that we are diverse in our minds, just like we're diverse in our ethnicity, gender, sexuality, etc. Neurodivergent is an umbrella term to describe an individual whose mind or functioning diverges from dominant societal norms, standards, or expectations, including learning, processing, interpreting, feeling, behaving, etc. Neurodivergence can be acquired or genetic, a fundamental part of your identity, or not. Neurotypical is a term to describe an individual whose functioning falls within the domain of societal norms. Neurotypical is the opposite of neurodivergent. Neurodiverse is a term to describe a group or population of people who have different minds or brains compared to each other. And neuronormative or neuronormativity is a set of standards, expectations, and norms that center certain ways of functioning as the superior and right way. Now, the reason these terms are important is because the majority of Sunny and I's conversation was focused on how bad is often different and different is often bad. But who set the baseline and is that right? And I think regardless of whether you identify as neurodivergent, as transgender, cis, normative, or any of these terms, we had a really good discussion around the existential nature of how we label things. When is it helpful and not helpful? And really destigmatizing different. I really enjoyed our discussion. Sunny is incredibly intelligent and had a lot of unique viewpoints. I hope you enjoyed as much as I did. So without further ado, here's Sunny. Okay, Sunny, we started this last episode with a question that our listeners found helpful. So I want to ask it again, because I think it's quite a nice jump off point to an interview like this. And that is, what is an opinion that you have that's probably controversial, the more controversial, the better, about mental health that you wholeheartedly believe?
I'm not going to share my most controversial opinion because that's, I don't fair. Think many people are ready for that. But I think some mental health conditions, some mental health diagnoses are not inherently distressing or dangerous or harmful. There are many mental health diagnoses that don't actually need to be fixed or treated or cured.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, is that the moment we say mental health, I think we assume that something's wrong, but a lot of times it could just mean different. And different doesn't necessarily mean better or worse. It just means atypical to the norm.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. So do you remember the first time that you felt different?
I was in kindergarten. So I would have been about 4 years old. But that's when I was introduced to the psychiatric system, when I started seeing psychiatrists and started seeing doctors, and they were all telling me that there was something wrong with me. So I think, you know, a lot of it, I guess for me personally, in kindergarten, I do remember feeling so different to the other kids around me, and that was reflected in how they treated me. So I was very young when I first felt different.
Yeah, I can imagine that would be very overwhelming and probably disorientating, given that you were that young and you were trying to make sense of the world, and the world is telling you that something's not going how it's quote unquote supposed to. Is there any particular thing that a psychiatrist or medical professional did or said that really sticks in your mind around that age of being somewhat harming or triggering?
Back then, I think one of the most harmful things that a psychiatrist did to me or said about me was they said I was a narcissist. And this was when I was about 6 years old. And I remember being 6 years old, I actually called it naughtyism because, one, I couldn't pronounce narcissism, and two, I didn't actually understand what that meant. So I thought, you know, they were just calling me naughty. So I called it naughtyism. And I think, you know, being labeled with that term so young is, well, one, baffling. And two, you know, obviously they didn't mean it in a positive way. So it, you know, led to me believing certain things about me that weren't true and were stigmatizing.
And I know that ended up building up to be quite a heavy burden to hold, because, correct me if I'm wrong, at the age of 11, you attempted an overdose. Is that correct?
Yes. I started trialing different psychiatric medication when I was about 7 years old. And then between the ages of 7 and 10, you know, we were trying to find the right medication. Then when I was about 10 years old, they found the right medication. And when I was 11, in year 6, I believe, or year 5, I decided to take more than I was meant to, because I thought it would, you know, make me better quicker, because that's what medication was, you know, that's how medication was communicated to me, that the medication was there to fix me. It was there to make me better. So, you know, in the logic of a kid, taking more means you get better quicker.
I can see how you make that link for sure.
Yeah.
Was there any part of you at that age that wanted to die?
Oh, absolutely. 100%. Which is why following that first overdose, I had numerous attempts. I'd say yearly, if not more than yearly, for the next 10 years.
Wow. I don't know, if you haven't been there, it's really hard to get in the mind of someone who's scraping by like that. I mean, to some extent, I can relate to your story, even though it had, you know, a different manifestation. I do know what it's like to go day by day and wonder if the last one's coming, because you just get so exhausted. Is that how you felt?
Definitely. I think, you know, it's exhausting living every day not wanting to exist, living every day as if believing you don't deserve to be alive. And obviously, you know, now I'm not suicidal. So sometimes I do think back on those days and I can't imagine, you know, my entire life revolved around me not wanting to exist, you know, the world being too much, believing that I deserve to not be alive. And so to put myself in that frame set, that mindset I used to have, is hard even for me, because it is so dark and different to, you know, how we should be thinking and feeling.
I'm so happy to hear you say that. You know, that it feels so foreign, and the degree to which it feels foreign is a really good indicator of how far we've come. And you exactly. And I both know that it's an ongoing management thing, but if there's still a sense of foreignness to that darkness, it means that we've grown a lot. And I'm interested to hear, Sunny, what exactly were they medicating you for?
They were medicating me for ADHD, they were medicating me for autism, and they were medicating me for Tourette's. But more specifically, they're also medicating me as a teenager for the depression and, you know, self-harm. But specifically for my, I guess, what they used to call my outbursts. Apparently I had very poor behavior, and, you know, I was naughty and had a lot of meltdowns, or in their eyes, outbursts and tantrums. And they were medicating me for tics and stimming, and basically they wanted me to be more well behaved because my mum found it really hard to manage me and everything.
As you would lead up to one of these, what other people would call meltdowns or outbursts, what are some of the feelings that, or what are some of the thoughts that were going on inside you that were felt like a volcano?
Oh, that's a hard one, because I think, because even now I still get the occasional meltdown. You know, that is a part of being autistic. But back then, so meltdowns, often it doesn't feel like there are coherent thoughts. It's mm-hmm. more like an avalanche, a volcano of like intense frustration and anger and overwhelm, and everything is just rising up and it gets too much that, you know, I wouldn't even be thinking actual thoughts. I'd just be feeling.
That's interesting. I wouldn't be thinking actual thoughts. I'd be feeling. And I think it sounds like the feeling wasn't anything in particular. It was this immense sense of unease and, as you say, incoherence. And do you know if the feeling was directed more toward yourself? Like, did you get angry and frustrated and volcanic at your own experience? I wish I wasn't like this. Or was it more at the world and externally? Why don't they get it? Why are they making me feel like this? Which way was the finger pointing?
Both. Sometimes it was towards me. And I think often, as a teenager, those meltdowns, those volcanoes towards myself manifested in self-harm and cutting up my clothes. Whereas the meltdowns, the feelings that were direct, were more responses to outside things, they manifested more externally, I would say. So I used to be the type of person where if I had a meltdown, I'd be put in my room and then I'd kind of thrash everything. I would, you know, knock my bookcases to the ground. I'd throw things at the wall. I would break everything. And those, you know, those meltdowns, I think, you know, those volcanoes were very terrifying to people around me. And that's what, you know, they really wanted to try to stop. But the thing is, those moments were a response to something that had happened. And so, you know, they were really targeting the wrong thing. They were trying to put a Band-Aid over something instead of like fixing the actual issue.
You sound like someone who's done a lot of work, not just obviously in therapy and on yourself, but you're quite educated in this space because you are being able to partition cause and effect and things like that. And that kind of leads me to, there's obviously this pain thread that's run up until a certain age, and then something has started to happen that has got you to where you are now, this incredibly coherent person who is speaking and authoring and changing the world and living what I can see as your authentic self. Can you talk me through what age that tide started to turn and what were the helpful factors?
Honestly, the tide didn't start turning till 2019. It was a very key year in the tide shifting. Because you are right, that pain thread, I think it's a very kind of a really good way to put it, because it was like there was this thread and that thread was snipped in 2019. It started fraying at the edges. Mm. I guess there were multiple factors. A big part of it was a huge shift in the way that I thought about things. And a lot of that was being introduced to the concept of neurodiversity and neurodivergence, because up until that day, you know, I had a stigmatizing understanding of autism and ADHD, but also mental health conditions, and mental health in general. And I had a lot of blame on myself. You know, I genuinely believed, oh, okay, I'm the issue. You know, what's that Taylor Swift lyric? It's me. Hi, I'm the problem. It's me. That, you know, was literally my life. So reframing my thinking was a huge part of it. And in saying that, I didn't reframe my thinking until, obviously, did a lot of trauma healing, but also had access to community. So I started learning from the right people. I started learning from lived experience. And then as well, developing actual good friendships and relationships. Up until then, I didn't really have any close friends. And the friends that I did have temporarily were not good. They weren't, you know, good friendships. And then I didn't have any healthy relationships either. And so, you know, in 2019, that's when I started having solid relationships, solid friendships. I had a good home environment where I had access to support and accommodations. I stopped working part-time. I have a feeling that was a huge part of it. So, yeah, community, relationships, friendships, reframing my thinking, access to support and accommodations. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So I'm going to play that back if that's okay, because I think there's a couple of really important things you said there, and it ties into a philosophy that I hold very dearly. I talk on stage about is the pretty much the thesis and epicenter to my books. Is it too simple to summarize the first step that you were referring to, which is that I started to let go of my own stigma as I started to move out of shame? Or does that feel right?
That feels very right.
I thought so. And in my experience, I've never seen someone properly heal. And I mean heal, like actually get better, form a solid foundation under their feet, start to experience joy, stable relationships and productive work, etc., until they have found an ability to sit with what is true, or said another way, have gone beyond just being stuck in that shame membrane that surrounds pain, and they've dropped the brave face and allowed themselves to move into who they are. And you know, otherwise it's just coping. Like so many tools, like the exercise and the even medication and accommodations, I don't think any of those tactics stick until you have gone beyond shame, because your biology, your psyche is not ready for that to receive and be fertile until the fertilizer of an open mind and a shameless mind to receive it. And no, I'm absolutely so glad that those conditions happen for you, whether that be through social education around neurodivergency, whether it's through people that came into your life in 2019, whatever happened led you to accepting who Sunny is. And that sounds like the catalyst for everything else to start to thread in a growth thread, not a pain thread, right?
Absolutely. Yeah, no, I completely agree. I think unpacking and getting rid of shame is a key part of everyone's journey. I don't think we can genuinely have a positive self-identity or, you know, a positive self-esteem or acceptance of ourselves without unpacking shame.
Amen. Amen. And then you draw me to a second point that I share an extremely similar viewpoint in, both my lived experience and my psychological research, is after shame's gone, the single best tactical intervention you can use to get better is building the right type of relationships around you. Like, connection is the greatest factor to our mental health outside of genetics and yes. biology. And yeah. our attachment style, our boundaries, all that stuff is the influence. It's the sensitive variable. And I don't think people truly get that who they have in their life and the way that they're interacting with them is compounding on the way that you feel.
Yeah, no, 100%. I believe like community and access to community and like relationships is so crucial. And we live in a very individualistic society. Yep. And so we really do underestimate the importance and power of having good relationships and good community.
Yes. And do you think that with regard to relationships and connection, DBT has been an important skill for you?
Yeah, absolutely. Obviously, I wrote a workbook on DBT, so it would be a little hypocritical of me if I didn't say DBT wasn't helpful. But yeah. DBT has definitely been helpful. I started using and learning about DBT, I would say, back in 2016, though I didn't start using it like properly till 2018. And I think part of the reason that I really, really found DBT beneficial was because it was focusing on, well, managing and reducing my distress rather than changing who I was. And I had a lot of distress back then. Obviously, being autistic in a neuronormative society means I do experience a lot of different types of distress. And DBT actually focuses on that. It gave me tangible skills to reduce distress and regulate my emotions. And I really needed that.
And just so we can plug it, can you please say the name of your workbook?
Yeah, so it's the Neurodivergent Friendly Workbook of DBT Skills. Bit of a mouthful, I know.
So awesome. And I love that you have taken that skill set and applied it to a specific audience. Like, so many people who are out there trying to create change in the world, it's this peanut butter approach. But you've gone, no, there's a community that I can really help. Here's a skill I can really, it's not mental health people that are struggling. It's DBT skills for neurodivergent people. And I love that because you're going to create impact using that type of focus. And I agree. I kind of set you up for that question so that we could geek out on DBT for a second, because I too think it's an incredibly therapeutic intervention. For those that are listening that might not know, it stands for dialectical behavioral therapy. It's a type of psychotherapy. I would say in the top three most recommended things you can do in therapy, from my perspective, outside of cognitive behavioral therapy and like somatic trauma healing, internal family systems. But if you have any type of attachment issues, if you are anxious, preoccupied, and you find yourself getting enmeshed and hurt a lot, if you are dismissive, avoidant, you're shut down, and you feel like life is turning into 2D and black and white, or if you're disorganized and you have an inability to self-regulate and you find yourself moving out of a stable state into a state of maybe chaos or reactivity, DBT is for you. And it was for me, and it helped me a lot to build a solid framework of who I was and then how to sustainably connect with others. And that was a game changer. So I'm so glad that you're a proponent and putting out the work. So shifting gears to neurodiversity, I've got the info sheet that I will read in the intro with regard to the term so that people know. But in plain English, in Sunny's words, what is neurodiversity to you?
Neurodiversity is literally just simply the diversity of human minds. It's just acknowledging the fact that every single brain or mind in the world is different. There is no blueprint for the perfect normal mind. Just like every single person is different, every single brain is different. And that's all it's acknowledging.
So it's celebrating as opposed to stigmatizing, which we've often done in the past, whereby if someone's not normal, they have a disorder. And what's your, how do you describe to people the difference between disorders and talking about things more from a neurodivergent angle?
Well, think of it this way. Disorder is a product of the pathology paradigm. And the pathology paradigm is the dominant framework or lens underpinning the DSM and psychiatry. It reinforces the idea that there is a normal brain, there is a normal mind, and there is a normal way to function. And if you don't function according to that way, or if you have a mind that is different to the normal mind, you have a disorder. So it really reinforces the idea that there is such thing as a normal mind. Whereas when we talk about neurodivergence, we are acknowledging that people aren't disordered because they are responding to trauma. People aren't disordered because they are experiencing distress. People aren't disordered because they communicate differently or feel differently. And it's not to say that neurodivergent people don't experience distress and challenges and struggles and difficulties, but it's not putting the problem onto the individual. Like, we can support people's distress, we can support people's challenges without framing them as something wrong with them. And that's a key difference between disorder and neurodivergence. If you're neurodivergent, you're not disordered. You diverge from neuronormativity, you diverge from how society wants us to function, but there's not anything wrong with us.
Yeah, and that's a beautiful callback to how we started this. I think this question, the opening question's got to stay, the opinion that's controversial, because we just linked straight to it now.
Yeah.
In that, I think your entire worldview that has been very helpful for you is changing the title of different from being a bad thing to a not just okay thing, in a lot of ways a good thing. And do you think that therapists in the modern age have a problem understanding and treating neurodivergent populations?
Absolutely. I think therapists are getting better when it comes to autism and ADHD, but there is still this idea that mental health conditions such as bipolar or OCD or schizophrenia or DID, dissociative identity disorder, are things that need to be fixed or treated or healed or gotten rid of. And I think that is, that's something that's very common, because obviously that's what we're taught. I have a psych degree myself. And that is what we are taught in psychology. So it does make sense that therapists and that are still finding that hard to shift, because, it's what we've been taught. It's the dominant framework for a reason. We've only just started making any progress with thinking about autism differently. So, of course, it's going to be a lot harder to think about mental health conditions differently.
Yeah, well explained. And I don't know if this is just me and the circles that I run in, but I'll just say what I've observed. I've observed a lot of people having adulthood or late stage ADHD diagnosis in the past kind of 24 months. I've had a lot of friends go, hey, I just found out I have ADHD. And that could just be a complete coincidence in the world that I'm living in, or it could be something else. Why do you think so many people get missed for the diagnosis of ADHD?
Why so many people get missed for the diagnosis of ADHD? I think there are a couple of factors that go into that. One, our understanding of ADHD is still very limited. It's similar to how our understanding of autism is very limited. A lot of the research on autism has been, you know, focused on a very, very narrow understanding, a very narrow definition, a very narrow representation of what autism is. And the same goes for ADHD. You know, often a lot of the research on ADHD is done on little boys, it's done on kids. And so how ADHD presents in women, in adults, in trans and non-binary people, in people who master ADHD, our understanding of that ADHD is not complete, and so people get missed. And then as well, you know, ADHD is a spectrum, just like autism is. And so there are people who, you know, ADHDers who have been working, who have been studying, who have been coping with their ADHD to the point that they're like, you know what, this is fine. This is just who I am. And then I think as well, COVID hit and people started working from home. It was a new environment and people were like, oh, hang on, how I've been, you know, pushing myself and coping for the past 20 years isn't really serving me right now. And so, you know, things are coming to the surface. When you're put into a different environment, you know, you start realizing, oh crap, I prefer working from home and rather than, you know, going to your 9-to-5 job. So then you realize, oh, hang on, there's actually, you know, something wasn't working there, or I was masking something.
And I think to your point around how the same diagnosis or disorder, if we subscribe to the Western clinical way of diagnosing people, can represent very differently according to psychographic information or other information. And I'm a big believer in what you just raised. Like the way that ADHD presents in women, for example, is very different to how it presents in men and very different to how it presents in non-binary folk. And we know that by looking at the traits, even depression, and the causation of depression is coming from a very different story that one is telling oneself often, depending on where they are at in their life and what their core needs are and what they define as important. And yeah, I think a lot of people can be missed because we have such a blanket view on diagnosing and treating mental health.
Yeah. And I feel like that is kind of an issue with diagnoses in general, is that we have a very rigid box with very rigid criteria. And if you don't meet that criteria, obviously you're not given a diagnosis. But what if that criteria is generalizing, is a blanket statement, is missing the nuance, is not intersectional? So that rigid box, you know, ends up, well, pushing people out of it.
Yeah. And I think what I'm hearing from you, and again, please jump in to correct, I'm just going to summarize and play back, that labeling in rigid ways isn't helpful, but creating an umbrella that people can unite around is helpful. So for example, ADHD doesn't sound like it fit well or was necessarily therapeutic for you, but neurodivergent fit well and felt therapeutic for you. So can you talk to me about your viewpoint on labels?
Yeah, so that's interesting because I have genuinely found my ADHD label and my autism label and my bipolar label and my BPD label and my dyslexia, my OCD, I've found all those labels very helpful. But I have found the neurodivergent label even more helpful. And I do see the neurodivergent label and the diagnoses labels as having different purposes. And so my autism label, my bipolar label, my ADHD label, they have a different purpose to my neurodivergent label. And I do believe that labels can be very harmful, but I also believe labels can be helpful. So when it comes to neurodivergent, it is a very important label for me because it is me rejecting the idea that I am disordered. It's rejecting the idea of saying that I have a diagnosis, which means there's an illness within my brain, because that's what disorder means. It's the psychiatric way of saying disease or illness, that there is something wrong with your brain. And I reject that concept. I don't agree, which is why neurodivergent is so important. And I think as well, at the end of the day, individual labels like autism and ADHD and bipolar are helpful because society has made them necessary. We rely on a diagnosis to access healthcare, to access accommodations at work, to access accommodations within, school. We rely on it to get NDIS, to get therapy. And so we do find those labels helpful because we've become reliant on them. But at the same time, you know, I didn't learn a positive understanding of autism until I met other autistic people. And if we didn't have that label, I might not have ever found community. But at the same time, so that means those labels are really helpful. I wish we could have, bipolar and schizophrenia and autism and that, but without the bullshit, without the stigma, without the harmful stereotypes, without the reinforcement that it's a disorder, that there's something wrong with us. But on the other hand, neurodivergent is a very important identity because it is rejecting the idea that we're disordered. And it's moving away from pathologizing us and instead being like, hey, yeah, like we diverge from neuronormativity. We all have that in common. Whereas if I just relied on the autism label, I would miss out on connecting with people who have a different label but still identify as neurodivergent. And I think as well, neurodivergent is a way for people to think about things differently. And so that's a completely different community for me.
Yeah. First of all, I agree that something can be helpful and not helpful at the same time. We don't need to put it in a box. And I think you explained really well just then that there's multiple use cases where this can and can't be a good thing for you and others. I wonder if we change the word. It sounds like disorder is the word that's probably not overly, I don't know what it's doing. Like, it is stigmatizing in and of itself. Like, maybe if we called them experiences, so like bipolar experience, a attention deficit experience, an obsessive compulsive experience, as opposed to disorder, which means wrong, different for all the bad reasons, we might be able to harness the positives that you just explained in being able to identify with something and leaving the bullshit aside.
I agree because, funnily enough, in the first two editions of the DSM, disorder didn't actually exist. Everything was labeled as a response. And then it wasn't until the third edition of the DSM that disorder was introduced. And so I do kind of think that at the beginning, they weren't perfect, but response was a lot better than disorder because I feel like that's a lot more accurate, especially for, let's go with PTSD. It's a response to trauma. It's not a disorder within the individual. It's a response. The same with anxiety. It is a response. The same with I believe with eating disorders. Eating disorders are a response. It's a coping strategy. It's a response to a lot of things. Prolonged grief disorder, that's a response to grief, obviously. And so I feel like, yeah, focusing on removing or reframing the word disorder and focusing on how things are a response or a divergence is really important. So I actually kind of like to swap out the D for divergence. So it's bipolar divergence, you know, autism spectrum divergence. makes me feel a little bit better.
Yeah. I think the part of that that really hit home for me is the premise that if it's called disorder, again, the through line in this talk is that you want to avoid it and run away from it. Whereas a response or a divergency really implies that there is valid reason and cause for this, whether it's through nurture and environmental factors and trauma, or whether it's through nature where your biology or your chemistry is off for reasons outside of your control. But both of them have a very strong aspect of not blaming yourself, as opposed to a disorder you take on as I am a piece of shit. And we do not want that, because people don't get well when they walk around thinking that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that's the key thing, is that disorder puts the blame on the individual by saying that there's something wrong with the way our brain is working. And I don't think I don't think shame is productive for multiple reasons.
Yep. We are 100% on the same page on that one. So, Sunny, I want to now talk about something that I spend pretty much my whole life doing, which is helping people connect. And we're connecting right now. And I run a course called Real Conversations, where we teach people how to drop from the head to the heart and actually understand someone as opposed to try and fix them. Can you tell me about an experience, a positive experience of connection, where someone has supported you in a way that was super helpful, and an example of that? And can you also tell me about an experience where someone has tried to be helpful, but they've actually made you feel heaps worse?
Oh. I can think of the second a lot easier than I can think of the first.
Yeah. Let's start with that.
Yeah. Okay. So. Yeah. Okay. So I was at a community event where I was networking with important members in the community, and it was a fundraising event for a community center that I helped founded. And I was talking to different people, and I was being my autistic self. I do find socializing and communicating with people are very overwhelming and difficult. And so there were a couple of times where I would be in a group of three talking to people, and, you know, I wasn't sure how, like, you know, of like social norms and everything. So I was like, all right, well, I'm going to go over there now to go talk to them and say goodbye. And then I'd abruptly leave the conversation. And I had someone who was in the group with me and say, like, hey, like, that's really rude. You're being really rude right now. And it was really confronting being singled out like that, and to be, for lack of a better word, told off. And they did it a couple of times. That if I like stood there like awkwardly, like going like this, they'll be like, you need to stop that. Like, you're scaring people. So basically that night at the community event, I received a lot of policing on how I would act or how I would move or what I'd say. And afterwards, I like approached them. I'm like, hey, like, why did you do this? Like, it made me really uncomfortable, and it made me even more anxious, and it made me feel bad about myself. And they told me that they were trying to help me. They thought I would want to make a good impression, and they thought I would want people to they were trying to help me become more likable is what they said. And that was wrong. I'm a very likable person. And I think me being awkward or me being autistic doesn't make me any less likable. And so I understood that they had their best intentions at heart. They were trying to help me be likable, but by doing so, they were shaming my autism. They were making me feel bad about myself. They were reinforcing this idea of how someone should act onto me and expecting me to change. So that was, and I get that a lot, to be honest. I can be very blunt or I can be really awkward, and then people will label that as rude or mean or standoffish. So, yeah.
That's such a powerful story, because I think a lot of people listening can identify when they've taken it upon themselves in moments in the past to call someone out or tell someone to do something because they think they have that someone else's best interest at heart, and without checking what is their best interest, like what are you actually wanting out of this experience? We're just assuming that we're being helpful when we're not, and potentially that helpfulness can come in a way that's delivered in a shameful response as opposed to a constructive or curious response.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
What about a conversation, Sunny, where you're like, wow, this has been an incredible experience, maybe with a friend or...
All right, so firstly, I'm not great at thinking of examples. Thinking off the top of my head has never been a skill set of mine. So there is one example that was quite recent, because it's easier for me to think of more recent examples. And it's an interesting one, because I normally wouldn't have ever phrased it as like a super positive experience, but in a way it was. So I recently got top surgery. And I never told my mum. I didn't tell her. And then when I came out after top surgery, that's when she found out. So it was, you know, surprise. And my mum obviously had concerns and confusion, and she didn't agree. And when I finally had the conversation with her about it, she told me that she doesn't really understand. She doesn't necessarily agree, but she said to me, "You've always been different and you always do what you want to do. And I respect that, and I'm going to support you and love you anyway." And then she was like, "Are you going to go on testosterone?" And I'm like, "I'm not sure. If I do, it'll be to change my voice." And she was like, "All right, I think I don't get that, but I'll still love you. Like, I'll still support you." And to be honest, that is probably the most positive experience I've ever had with my mother. And I think that was one of the most powerful things that she could have done, one of the most positive things that she could have done. It doesn't matter if she doesn't understand me. It doesn't matter if other people don't understand, you know, how my brain works or who I am. It doesn't even matter if they don't agree for whatever reason. But that unconditional acceptance, that unconditional support is so important. I think that's so powerful. That, yeah, just that unconditional acceptance that, hey, you know what? I don't get it. I don't really understand, but I'm going to love you anyway. I'm going to accept you anyway. That's really powerful.
Super powerful. And it's interesting where, yeah, they might not agree. They might not understand because they don't have a frame of reference. But I think it's both, to me, and I don't want to put words in your mouth because your response was fantastic. And just by the way, you're amazing at thinking up off the top of your head. I think you're discrediting yourself. We've done that for the last 45 minutes and you've come up with incredibly insightful answers.
I always
define understanding not by one's sphere of reference, but one's curiosity to understand my sphere of reference. So, for example, as someone who's not transitioning myself, who's heterosexual, cisgender, is that the correct terminology? Yep.
Yes.
And I can't say I get it from my own lived experience or belief systems, but I can understand you by being curious around why that's important to you. What hurts by that not happening? What desires are achieved if that does happen? What's the stories that are playing out in your head? And then once I know that, I then have a sphere of reference because all human needs and all human pains are universal. They just look different on the surface. So I think I agree with your point that someone might not need to agree or have their own sphere of reference, but I think we all have the capacity to unconditionally accept and understand their sphere of reference. Does that make sense?
Yep. No, that actually makes a lot of sense. And I think that's, very true and applicable actually, because my mum said to me that helped her acceptance and understanding was she saw photos of me afterwards and she was like, wow, like you look happy. You look happier. And that really helped her acceptance. And I think that's kind of, she developed an understanding of my understanding that to do so, to transition makes me happier. And she understands that. She doesn't understand like the gender side of things, but she understands my happiness and well-being.
Hmm. What an incredibly uplifting, mature, educational conversation, Sunny. I'm so honored and grateful that you've let us into a window of your world. And to kind of bring us home and round us out, I'm going to ask 1 to 3 remaining questions. The first one I like to ask is, was there a question that you wish I'd asked, but I didn't?
No, actually, I think you asked some really good questions that prompted some very important conversations.
Great. What's one book that you would recommend other than your own?
There's an incredible book that's just come out called Decolonizing Therapy, and it's by Dr. Jennifer Milan, and it's all about going into the roots of therapy and reclaiming, decolonizing therapy and the importance of community care. And, it's basically just a very, very good book and I really recommend it. Yep.
Lovely. And last but not least, Sunny, where can we find you online if we want to keep in touch or be part of your community?
Instagram at Lived Experience Educator. And then I'm also on LinkedIn, Sunny Jane Wise.
Perfect. It's been a pleasure and looking forward to staying connected and in your community.
Thank you for opening the window to this awesome conversation.
My emotions have a natural tendency to dissipate unless they get reinforced. And so if there's more thoughts, more stories, more intentions come along. So the act of how am I leaving it alone is an act of not adding more stories, adding fuel to it. So it might not go away in 2 minutes, but then it begins to relax and dissipate. And so rather than being the person who has to fix it, we become the person who makes space for the heart, the mind, to relax and settle away itself.